This is Andrew and Wolf. My topic this week is Carthage.
I'm glad you pronounced that for me.
You didn't know how to pronounce the word Carthage?
You know, I thought I did, but it seemed like it might have a little twist to it that maybe I wasn't getting, but okay.
Carthage? What? Carthage, maybe?
I think it's just like maybe I was thinking Carthage, although I knew that was wrong. So I'm just happy you pronounced it.
Alrighty, well,
I'm also glad you're covering it, because it's an interesting topic, because
it's a city in Africa, right, which had, you know, a lot of history with ancient Rome. I'm sorry, you were saying?
I'll let you continue.
So, Carthage is both a city that fought several wars with ancient Rome, and a relatively recent cocoa dependency resolution infrastructure. So that's a mouthful.
Yeah.
So what does that mean? Well, it's similar in a lot of ways to what CocoaPods does. So a lot of people know what CocoaPods is now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm ignorantly skeptical on this, so I'm very excited to learn about it.
Ignorantly skeptical.
Yes.
Very nice.
Like, I'm like, what's wrong with CocoaPods? So I want to hear.
Really? Yeah. We've talked about CocoaPods.
Yeah, right, yeah, but I mean.
And you've talked about CocoaPods now. Edgecase is episode 49, like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a link to that. In the show notes, I remember nothing about what you actually said.
That's okay, neither do I.
Yeah, really. Now, I remember when we went over this, I was like, Wolf's going off on one of his obscure topics again. I suspect even at the time, it was getting to be really popular. And since then, I believe it's gotten possibly even more popular, possibly just continued that success. Mm-hmm. To the point where basically almost every project I've ever used since I started at Black Pixel a little while ago, everybody uses it now.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody uses it. It's really become a kind of de facto standard for the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're going to basically talk about both of them quite a bit.
Okay, good.
In the next couple minutes. Now, so CocoaPods has been around for at least 2 years, probably more like three or four. Carthage is probably, what, like 6 months?
Maybe a little longer? Yeah, it's on the newer side, that's for sure.
Now, the public face of Carthage is Justin Sparsummers, I guess, friend of the show. I don't know if he actually listens to the show, but I know him. I've met him. Nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's done a number of presentations on it. Now, the one that I was able to listen to was a podcast for iFreaks, and I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's PH, not F, mm-hmm. for iFreaks. It's on DevChat TV, and they talked with Justin about Carthage. And I think it was probably a couple of months ago. He also did a presentation at the offices of Realm, mm-hmm. in San Francisco recently. Now, I don't think the video for that is up yet. I was unable to make it, unfortunately. I wish I could have been able to see that. Although I think it was on the night that we record, so it would have been problematic anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a webpage for it. It's on GitHub. So github.com/Carthage C. So it's the Carthage project by the Carthage user. Now, the name, I'm just making some jokes about the name here, but the name doesn't happen to mean anything. There's no historic significance to it. There's no, you know, deep, Carthage is like CocoaPods, like Carthage was like Rome. No. Apparently, Rob Rex came up with the name because it sort of sounded like package.
Okay.
That's as deep as it goes. And by design, it is supposed to be really simple. So it's a lot simpler than CocoaPods. And we'll go over a bunch of ways that that's the case. CocoaPods is a centralized system, although I think that centralization came a little later. I don't think there was just one directory for all the pods. I think that was something that they had to kind of work up to, from what I remember. But nowadays, if you say, well, you need a pod that is within our centralized repository or centralized directory, and then you go look and say, well, what pods are available, and you find your pod, and then you use it. In Carthage, there's no central list, and there's no plan for a central list. When you specify what projects you want to have in your project, you need to specify a GitHub or a Git repository. And so it goes to each of those places separately. Now, CocoaPods, when it is setting up its dependency analysis, when it's setting up usage of all of these sub-projects, I guess I never really went over about exactly what dependency resolution infrastructure, what even that means.
Mm-hmm.
The simple case is, you know, you have your application, let's call it A, and it needs two libraries, B and C. And you could bring those libraries in using Git submodules, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that would just check them out within your repository checkout. But then what if they needed other things mm-hmm. as well? They needed other modules. And more interestingly, what if they needed the same module? So B and C both needed library D. Mm-hmm. You would have to figure all that stuff out for yourself. And let's say they needed D, but one of them needed version 2 and one of them needed version 2.3. And so what these systems are supposed to do is give you a way to sort of figure out, well, what's the optimal version of all of these dependent libraries that we can check out for you and bring in and bring into your project. Now, what CocoaPods does is it says, I'm going to kind of take over parts of your project to do this for you. Because CocoaPods, at least in its default configuration, uses static libraries. And there's no... You have to kind of fiddle around in Xcode quite a bit to get static libraries to build into your project in the way that you would want them to. And CocoaPods does all that for you. Whereas Carthage says, well, we're basically not going to change your project at all on you. And they do this for several means. They say, well, we're not going to support static libraries. Now, CocoaPods also supports dynamic libraries now, but I haven't used it. I think that's really new. Mm-hmm. Carthage only supports dynamic libraries. So that's actually one of the things that is keeping me from recommending it right now, because in iOS, at least, dynamic libraries are only supported as of iOS 8 mm-hmm. and up, so the current version of the OS. And that's a hard sell for most shipping commercial projects to say, oh, you know, only do the very top level OS. There are some projects that can get away with that, but most can't. Most have to support at least one back from that. But that was, you know, that was kind of their line in the sand. We're keeping it simple, so we're only going to do that. And so Carthage will check out the project that you need in the same way that CocoaPods will check out the project that you need and build them for you. But then it's up to you to take the resulting binary and drag it into your project as a dependency. And that's one way that they're a little easier to deal with, because if you have a static library, you might also have resources. You might also have any number of other files. And CocoaPods will deal with all of that for you, but it will deal with that by making its own kind of separate project mm-hmm. rules and scripts and all this complication. And Carthage says, no, we're not going to bother with that. You make the dynamic framework, drag it in, and you're done. Mm-hmm. That's all that we do for you. Now, when you say, okay, I've got an application and I need library B and C, you specify that through similar means, through these two things. In CocoaPods, it's a pod file that lists the dependencies that you're going to have. And there's a whole language to it for CocoaPods. Carthage is, of course, simpler. They have a cart file that, again, you just put lines down saying, well, I need this and I need this. And there's different aspects to it. You can go read the website to see some more details about it. And they both, and I think in a good way, they both say building your project normally is separate than us doing an update pass. So Carthage has a command line tool. I think CocoaPods has a command line tool. I think it's just pod, right? Mm-hmm. Carthage is Carthage. When you install their stuff, you get this command line tool. And both of them, I think, is just update. And that goes through and then goes through all your dependencies and goes out and checks against the repositories and said, is there a newer version that satisfies what you've said you want for these? And again, it downloads it. And in CocoaPod's case, it will update the projects for you. In Carthage's case, it will not do that, but it will get what you need. Now, if you want to make a library for it, first part is, you know, okay, I have an application and I'm going to pull in these other libraries for use. Making the application work is relatively simple, pulling those other things in by making your pod file. But then the person making the library also has to make it compatible with these systems. And, you know, there are different things to do for the two systems. And with Carthage, the one that I tried, it was much simpler. Again, that's the pattern. You make a dynamic library target in your project. You share your scheme. You make your scheme public. And then you're pretty much done. You can use it pretty much as is from there. CocoaPods, have you tried making a CocoaPods library?
It's been done for me indirectly for a number of my projects. I think I took a swipe at it, but I didn't have enough time, so I don't think I completed it. So other people have been doing it for me. So I've been always relied on the kindness of strangers.
Or friends?
Oh, yeah, that too. Friends of the show.
Yeah. Okay. So the when I downloaded, because I wanted to try sort of both of them side by side, but I found that the CocoaPods library template that you download from Pod, there's a certain thing you can do with the Pod command line tool to download a template. Mm-hmm. And it's by its own documentation, it calls itself opinionated. It has all of these kind of rules and places for things. It wants you to put things in a certain place and arrange things in a certain way. It is not simple in my mind. And it makes a certain amount of sense because they have to do more work to get all of your resources and all your stuff into someone's project because they're supporting static libraries. But it was still a little much for me. I didn't have the time to do much more with it. Again, Carthage is easier. They have said, Justin has said publicly, that you know their hope was to make something that was a lot simpler. I wonder, he didn't actually come out and say, well, you know, my God, we want to make it so much simpler than CocoaPods because CocoaPods is really too complicated. It's interesting the kind of line he walks when he talks about these things because it's, you know, it's pretty obvious that if you're going to make something new, it is in contrast to the old version, right, to the other thing. But, you know, trying to keep it friendly, I applaud that. It's a good idea.
Yeah, totally.
Everybody should stay friends. So let's see. Both systems appear to handle nested dependencies by kind of flattening them, which I think is the way to do it. So if you have, you know, library B that depends on library D, what CocoaPods does is it kind of goes through all those nested dependencies and finds them all, but then it kind of brings them up so that all of those libraries, you don't build the D into B and then just link against B. You build B and D separately, and then you link against both of them. That makes sense?
Yeah.
And you have to do the same thing, I believe, with dynamic frameworks, because you can't have nested. I mean, in theory, you could make one static library by just throwing all the other stuff into the static library, but you can't embed one dynamic framework into another using Apple's APIs. I don't think you can do that. So the only way they could do it was by bringing them all together and then linking them all into your application. But that does work. I did try it with Carthage, and that does work. One thing I did not get to try is conflicting dependencies.
Right.
I mean, that's one of the whole points of these things, so I'm sorry I didn't get to it. But the hope would be that if you have, you know, library B and library C, and library B says, well, I want version 1 of library D, and library C says I need version 2 of library D, then it, and, you know, not no range, just 1 and 2, and so you can't have both. And that's one of the whole things that this thing does, is it says, well, if two libraries need another library, and they both need it, we'll only include it once. So that's one of the ways that they're very helpful. But then if they do have a conflict between them, so now if one of them said, well, I can use versions 1 and up, another one said, well, I can use version 2 and up, then, you know, then you bring version 2 in and then you're done because that satisfies both of them. And that, as far as I know, is how they work. That seems to work pretty well in CocoaPods from what I've seen. But I did not get to try that in Carthage myself. Now, it's interesting that Carthage went ahead and said, well, we're going to kind of throw away a lot of legacy stuff. We're not going to worry about compatibility. We're not going to worry about old-time support. But it is, so that's the good side of it. The bad side is that CocoaPods is already pretty entrenched. Mm-hmm. That, you know, if every project that you know about is already using CocoaPods to bring in its modules, then to switch to Carthage, even though Carthage is simpler to set up by default, you would need a lot of work to get Carthage to happen for all these projects, especially because all these projects right now are generally static libraries, and Carthage doesn't support static libraries. And I'm pretty sure that even if CocoaPods said, all right, now everybody switch to dynamic libraries, they would, because Carthage requires you to make a particular change to your project, you have to point to the place in the Carthage directory where the dynamic library was built. That's going to be a different place than wherever CocoaPods puts it. Mm. So you can't use the same, you know, the same branch, the same version of your code to support both at the same time.
Interesting.
It doesn't seem like it. Now, someone might come back and say, oh, no, I was able to make it work in this fine way. But it seems, at least in theory, that you can't support both at the same time. You've got to choose one. One interesting example of this is AF networking. Because AF networking currently only supports the static library of CocoaPods. Mm-hmm. And there was actually not a blog post, but there was a webpage where they talked about this, an issue on GitHub, where people were saying, hey, could you support dynamic libraries? And this was specifically in the context of Carthage, but people were saying, well, we'd also like this in general. And Matt Thompson, mm-hmm. Matt T, specifically said in response to someone, it's a question of the support burden. Mm-hmm. So he said, no, we're only going to support static libraries.
Interesting.
We're never going to support dynamic frameworks. Mm-hmm. So that really leaves you in a bit of a bind if you want to. You know, everybody uses AF networking. Everybody in the world throws it in. I'm not sure that's such a good idea, not because it's not a good framework, because it's pretty heavyweight. And I would say that if your application is meant to be sort of a networking kind of heavyweight application, an application where networking is really important and really central to what you do, you might want to dig down directly into the Apple frameworks, especially because they've been adding better ones. But if you use it, and a lot of people do, you can't use it in Carthage, really, unless you fork their code base, mm-hmm. at which point you're going to need to keep forking their code base because AF networking is under very, very intense ongoing maintenance.
Okay.
They're making a lot of changes to it. And so I just don't see that as being workable. Mm-hmm. Now, you can mix and match. You can have some things working with Carthage and some things working with CocoaPods. I don't know why you would, right? Because then you have to update twice to get all your projects updated. And so I wouldn't tend to do that for my projects. I couldn't do that yet for most of the projects that I've worked on because I need to support iOS 7. So there are some issues so far with adopting Carthage. And I'm not sure quite what's going to happen with it. I suspect that, you know, there needs to be a better... Because CocoaPods is really easy to use, mostly. When it works well, even though it is sort of complex and does require a lot of changes, which could go wrong. But when it works pretty well. And so for Carthage saying, well, all we need to do is, you know, these simple steps, well, they're not really that much simpler than CocoaPods right now. So I suspect that more will have to happen before Carthage gets too widespread adoption. But I don't know. Justin is well known and well liked, and so maybe more people will try it for that reason. Mm-hmm. I do like it, but I also don't know if I'll take extra steps to use it to replace CocoaPods with it. At least not yet.
Okay. Oh, that's very enlightening. Well, thank you. Mm-hmm. So my topic is that text is a symptom. And so it's I'm going to contradict myself a bit in the last episode, 127, A Foundation of Chaos. I kind of talked about my feelings of growing warmth towards flexible foundations. And so I'm kind of going to argue against myself here that talk about text itself. So text, as we has a bunch of pros. It is easily reversible. It's diffable. It's timeless and archivable. Everything from the 70s and 60s we can still look at quite nicely on our modern MacBooks. and so Doug McElroy is quoted on Wikipedia talking about the Unix philosophy, saying, write programs that do one thing well, do one thing and do it well. Write programs to work together. Write programs to handle text streams, because that is the universal interface. And so this is, he believes that text is the universal interface. And darn it, he might be right, and this is problematic. Because text has a bunch of problems that no one really seems to talk about. And so I'm going to kind of run through the list that kind of popped into my mind. To kind of give a wider kind of structure for this, I want to kind of go up a level and talk about this human-computer interaction concept called affordances. I first learned about affordances through Don Norman's classic book, The Design of Everyday Things. I recommend everyone read it. It's a classic book, timeless. so he has this concept of affordances. And so he makes the claim that you have... I believe he said 10,000 objects in your everyday life that you have to interact with. And in order to interact with them, it's like that. This is quite a catalog of things you have to basically memorize how to work, how to use. And his argument is that maybe we don't memorize it. Maybe we have kind of a basic understanding of our physiology. And when we look at objects, we kind of know how our bodies work, and we can kind of deduce on the fly how we should work. And granted, this is a forced habit, obviously, and education goes a long way. But his argument is that when you look at a spoon, it's not necessarily that you're going to your habits or your memory banks to actually remember how exactly to use a spoon. Is that it has this long portion on it that looks like a handle, and so you deal with a lot of different things in your life that all have handles, and so when you look at a spoon and you see that long thing and you know how your hands work, that you can leverage these patterns together and kind of add one and one together, and you can figure out, this looks like something that's grabbable. And there's also things that are false affordances. So the classic is that if you, like, you go to push on a door that actually had a little inset that you had to pull on it. So we've all made that mistake, and it had the affordance of something you push because it didn't have a handle. At least it wasn't obvious until you made the blunder of actually trying to push on it, which actually is a funny story that in my first WWC that I went to in the San Jose Convention Center, I tried to walk through the front door to register, and I got stuck in the doors. And this is actually mentioned in the design of Everyday Things, where
you getting stuck at WWDC?
That was before I was drinking too. Amazing. Oh. So the doors of the San Jose Convention Center are glass doors that all look very pretty, and it's very easy to how they set up the door handles is that they're kind of not obvious. It's very easy when you're walking through them is that you can get slightly off-centered. And so that is you can, instead of walking through the matching pair of doors, you can get off by one essentially. And then the doors don't work. So it gets even worse because then you're like, I guess the convention center is closed, and you'll spin around. And then the doors are locked on the other side because you're still off by one on when you try to exit. So all of a sudden you're trapped in the glass tunnel. It's funny because like I actually made that mistake and I felt like deja vu when I was doing it when I realized it was because I had read Don Norman's book on it. But anyway, so my argument here is that text has affordances, and the affordances, there are no solutions, only trade-offs, right? And obviously, text has a bunch of winning aspects to it. I've listed in the pros section. But there are trade-offs, there are downsides. And one of the affordances of text is that because I know we bring this up a lot in the show, but it's a bit of an attractive nuisance that you look at text and it's immediately obvious what you're looking at. There's the complexity is plain. So it invites reversing. And so you look at text and you're like, I can write a parser for this. And the problem is that everybody's got a bad parser. And if you look at the history of software bugs, and especially how like most programs are being broken nowadays, like do jailbreak your iPhone, it's because of bad parsers. Even parsers on strict, well-known data structures can easily be fuzzed and found to be broken. And text is open to all sorts of interpretation, and things have gotten even much, much worse with Unicode. So this is why when we say that write programs to handle text streams because that is the universal interface, well, that's problematic because if every small program has to have its own little text parser in it, that's a lot of code surface area that's going to screw things up. And this idea of writing programs to handle text streams because it's the universal interface, to me reflects a fundamental pessimism of a modern software today. That it makes people, I feel that people have basically given up. And like, text, this is as good as we can get. That's the end of story. And this, I think it's gotten a little bit better in the past few years with XML and to a greater extent JSON, that yes, we're still using text, but at least we're understanding that, maybe instead of this having willy-nilly, whatever crazy language we're coming up with now, maybe we should use these off-the-shelf components so we can then use, we can have these data formats that are well-known and that we can reuse these parsers that also are ripe with flaws, but at least when they're fixed in one place, they can hopefully be that those fixes can be rippled through the system and be fixed for a lot of different programs. Another problem with text is that it is serialized. And if you look at how data is structured, is that text, because it's in serial form and because of the way we look at it, we tend to favor linear and hierarchical structures because of how we look at it. Because representing an object graph, which is extremely easy in things like OmniGraffle or just a graphics program in general, is terribly difficult in text. What's that ASCII drawing program that just came out? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I don't. No, I don't.
It's a great program. I have to link to it because I just fell out of my head right now. But it's a great program. But barring that one great program that actually does a great job at ASCII art, it's like OmniGraffle for ASCII art. Text is terrible at this type of stuff. And so this very important concept of kind of a cyclical or acyclical object graphs, which is probably much more common than hierarchical, is difficult to express in text. And because it's difficult to express, you know, this is like that one theory about how when you don't have a word in language, you can't even express a concept. I don't buy into that altogether, but I think it has some merit. And likewise, we tend to favor linear and hierarchical data structures because we can represent that in text. And we tend to shy away from object graphs, even though I think it's a better fit for very many cases. And text is also, of course, terrible at data validity. This kind of ties into kind of the everyone's got a bad parser point. But a great example of this is the sudoers file on all Unix systems, or all modern Unix systems. That this is a file that basically says who can as root control the system, or at least can get admin access to the system. And this data format, you'd think it'd be, you know, maybe it'd be a simple little text file, kind of like the password file in Etsy. But it turns out it's its own little mini language, and it's complicated. It's very easy to make a syntax error in there. And if you make an error when you're editing it, guess what? You can't use sudo to go edit it anymore. You've locked yourself out of your own system.
Right.
So the workaround to that is that there is a program called vi sudo that you are supposed to use that when you're editing the sudoers file. And what it will do is that when you exit the program, it will run a validator against and won't let you exit or something like that. When it will say, hey, you know, you got a syntax error here. You really don't want to save this file, or you at least don't want to exit right now, or something like that. I haven't used it personally because I like to live dangerously. So I just go ahead and edit, and I haven't screwed myself yet. Although I probably will now.
Jinx.
Jinx. But this is a point. So this is instead of making the format simple or having a program that provided a higher level interface to it, they're relying on this complicated text, and they're kind of have this Band-Aid on it, or to kind of cover up this what I view as a glaring flaw. And it conflates, in text, conflates presentation with the mechanics of storage. So back in the classic Mac days, we had the resource manager. And the resource manager was essentially this kind of lightweight database. And I know the resource manager is not a bad database. Yes, old school Mac people. But the resource manager was essentially a lightweight database that you had essentially every file had two forks, a data fork and resource fork, and it was stored things by types and then by IDs, and then you have a data stream in there. And this was a very it was a very kind of lax data structure, but it was some data structure there. And it was amazing how this small data structure, as limited as it was, this was the backbone of the Mac operating system. All code resources were put in there. Window definitions, icons, all this. It was a very interesting database concept at the file level that was highly composable. And it was also very efficient because it was a binary format and it was supplied by the system. And it is the data that you needed. You didn't really care how it was stored. This was done for you. So with text, it's kind of like the security blanket thing, like Linus carries around his little blanket he can't get rid of. It's one of these things where we've been burned by computers by Soma for so much that so often that we don't trust them. And again, this is kind of a failure of computers in general. But if we can't see the underlying text, we're like, I don't trust the system. And it's a sad state of affairs, but I think it's something we kind of need to move on from. And I think that having that this kind of need to store text at the lowest possible levels reflects a fundamental insecurity that I think we can get past. And I know that on the Mac, classic Mac, that it was very rare to have something like a corrupt resource fork or something like that, at least in my experience. Not that it's never happened, but it worked very well. And you might say that with text, at least it's more salvageable, right? Because then you can pop it open and you can look for the bad characters there, or at least it's more obvious of what's going on. But with a binary format or something that is maybe isn't even necessarily binary. Like, I think a good kind of transition point here is what we're doing with the preferences on the modern Mac OS X, that where we store it in plists, right? So you are dealing with object graphs, NS dictionaries, NS strings, what have you, at a higher level, and these do get written out to textual streams. But aha, in modern, again, that's inefficient. And so what Apple was able to do, because they layered things correctly, was that they were able to introduce binary plists, which serialize and deserialize more rapidly. And then they provided a tool, to convert from text to binary format and back again. So I think this is probably a good model for how to move forward out of kind of this text everywhere idea that we have. And kind of move past this pessimism that since Apple moved to the binary plist system, I haven't had any problems with that. Granted, things like BBEdit will transparently, when I open up a binary plist, it transparently turns that into a text file for me. So it's been pretty transparent for me when I go to modify a file. I can still treat it as if it were a text file. But I think that's a good role model for kind of taking the systems as we know, and we've all been burned, and we're trying to learn to trust computers here, right? And I think this is a good model for kind of moving forward and giving computers more responsibility for managing the data for us, instead of just saying, this is text and you don't understand this at all and please don't touch it. So what do you think, Andrew?
Well, I didn't realize you hated text so much.
Yeah. It's one of my pillars of Unix hate.
Had a bad breakup with text when you were younger. I mean, I'm not the alternative to text being what? Being more structured forms of data?
Right. Things like JSON.
Okay. Because I actually I don't know it. I mean, JSON is still text. And binary plists are still text, in that they're made up of characters that are handwriting, that are based on human handwriting. Are you talking about sort of custom text formats versus standardized text formats?
No, I'm talking about like binary type stuff. So a binary plist is if you look at it, it is using. So text has this problem where it needs kind of the deliver problem, right?
Oh, that's right. So binary isn't the XML bytes just compressed down. It's actually a different format.
Exactly, right. It tends
to be
more kind of blocky.
Why do you think that's better, though? Why do you think it's better to have a binary format like that rather than a few more characters delineating the borders between different records.
It's because the parsers can be faster. The data is smaller, yeah. And mm-hmm. the parsers are also more secure and less exploitable.
They're probably less exploitable just because fewer, but they're less exploitable just in terms of more security through obscurity, because it would take someone longer to reverse engineer a binary format than to reverse engineer the text of, say, an XML or a JSON file.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I guess I'm coming at it from the other side, which is that I trust computers less and less the older I get. I would rather have multiple ways of getting at data, of understanding data that don't rely on the original vendor of a technology, because vendors come and go pretty quickly.
Sure.
Whereas we want to be able to hold onto this data for long periods of time. We don't, you know, not just for the 5 years that, you know, whatever, like Atari was around, or the, you know, 50 years Apple's going to be around. I want to be able to get at this data. Well, I won't be alive, but I want my descendants or my whatever, my relatives to get around to this data hundreds of years from now. And that's more likely to happen when it is actually more easy to reverse engineer in the future. And you don't have to rely on lost specifications from companies, specifications which might never have been publicly disclosed by these companies. So no, I understand the idea about efficiency and about security, but I do think that from a maintenance standpoint, from a human maintenance standpoint, I'd rather have things be more my data formats to be more understandable rather than less.
What about from an architectural standpoint? Do you think it's a good idea for all these small little programs to all have their own text parsers?
Well, and see, that's again where I think I'm not sure if we might be coming from a different assumptions, in that everybody always has a parser. You have a parser for binary formats as well. It's just that it's entirely custom. You're writing it from scratch every time with a new format. And with things like XML and JSON, you at least have a foundation from it that's from, you know, Apple has a JSON parser. There are open source XML parsers for iOS, for example. It's easy to make a mistake in any format. And you probably will. You probably will screw up mm-hmm. parsing formats because, as you said, it's complex. Fuzzers, right, can find problems. But they'll find problems with anything, because writing parsers is not something humans are very good at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether saying, well, let's go from text to binary formats will fix that. It might just actually make it harder to find the bugs, because now instead of someone saying, well, here's where you screwed up parsing this format, it'll be a binary format that no one knows how to parse at all. And that'll make it even harder to figure out. I don't think that makes a big difference in terms of bug potential in my mind.
Okay.
I have some news that will probably come as a surprise to our listeners. This is the last episode of Edge Cases. So Wolf and I have talked about it before. Wolf mentioned it a couple times leading up to our 100th episode that we would be ending it. We did finally decide to continue in a new format after that, but now we're going to be ending it. So I've really enjoyed being part of the show, presenting a whole bunch of mostly Apple-related topics, hearing from our listeners every so often. So I'll give a little spiel at the very end, but Wolf, any last comments?
Any last words? Firing squad, yes. Type thing? Yeah, do I get a cigarette? I think my entire thrust with 100 episodes was that, I didn't have, we said everything by then, right? It's a nice round number and all that. Although I will say that 128 is a nice round binary number, so we have that going for us. And man, 256 episodes, that's another long stretch there. I've really enjoyed recording with you as well. Podcasting is a great, with the recording schedule, it's a great channel for kind of getting out these thoughts that, I don't know, there's such a formality about blog posting, at least, unfortunately, in my mind, that maybe I just need to get over. But I found that having the weekly schedule has kind of made me much more kind of output-y, kind of productive in terms of sharing my thoughts with people. Mm-hmm. A lot of things that I would have never blogged about, I end up talking about extensively on this show. So I hope everyone enjoyed it, or at least enjoyed your episodes.
well, I'm sure they sure they enjoyed both of our episodes.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if you called it out, but odd episodes were me and even episodes were you. So if you, now I have to go back and check every episode, make sure we follow that rule, which I think we, for the most part, did. But yeah, so it was a really good, great experience. And it was funny that I figured, you know, at 100 episodes, I'd have nothing left, you know, I have nothing left to say. But as we're winding down the show here, I still have a backlog of like 8 things to talk about. So I guess I just always have something to talk about.
Right. And certainly we'll both, you know, maybe we won't both be putting out blog posts as often as we put out episodes, but I'm sure you'll still be hearing from us on the web. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to leave up the website and the Twitter account so you can still get to our old episodes and to, I guess, the Twitter account if you want to, whenever you like. And you can still follow us individually on Twitter, where we are both active. And so I will give those Twitter names one last time. So for me, it's Apontius, APONTIOUS. And for Wolf, yeah, I still have the rhythm there. Isn't that good?
Got it.
Wolf, his last name, Wrench. That's the word Rent, RANT, plus Z, plus SCH. So again, we hope you've enjoyed listening to us blather on. And we will see you around.